All right, so I'd like to welcome everybody to today's call. Today, I'm very fortunate to have Bedros Koulian, who is an extremely successful entrepreneur in the health and fitness industry on the line. And today, you know, I don't care what kind of business you're in, every now and again you find people that serve other people in the form of business, and they stand out from the crowd for very certain reasons. And that's the type of person I have on the line today. So, Bedros, thank you so much for offering your time to be on the line, and welcome to today's call.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jason. It's an absolute pleasure.
Awesome. So why don't you so on the line we have service providers of all shapes and sizes, from doctors, chiropractors, to massage therapists and consultants. So why don't you just tell everybody a little bit about your story, because you have quite a compelling one, and then we'll jump into some questions.
Sure, sure. So I'll kind of encompass it in a nutshell for you. I'm the, I guess you'd call the typical American dream story, and by that I mean in 1980 I was 6 years old. Unbeknownst to me, about a year and a half, 2 years before that, my father, we lived in communist Armenia at the time. It was governed by the Soviet Union. My father was saving up $25,000 in 1978 and 79 so that we can defect communist Armenia and come to the United States. And he had been working on getting paperwork together and et cetera. And the $25,000 was to actually bribe certain levels of the Soviet government to allow us to escape and go to Italy, and from Italy defect to the United States. Thankfully, we were able to get into the U.S. legally, like my father wanted, because everything he does is kind of by the book. Needless to say, he's not a fan of communism, and he's not a fan of having your rights and your freedoms taken away. And so we were kind of born into that, and knew there was something better. And so in 1980, summer of 1980, we arrived in Southern California. It was pretty much the whole family working to piece together money so we could have an apartment, a one-bedroom apartment for a family of five. And, of course, me being the youngest, my job was just to kind of hang around and not ask questions, because it would pretty much make my dad anger my dad. I mean, the guy had like three jobs. My brother had three jobs. My sister had three jobs. My mom had two jobs, and me. And so, you know, we were poor and broke. You know, people always ask me, well, what's the difference between poor and broke? And I say, you know, well, poor is where you're at financially. You know, you have no money. It's a state of mind. You're financially destitute. You're emotionally beat down. You have no language barrier in the country that you're in. You can't communicate with the people around you. And we were poor. And then there was broke, which is you're just completely out of money and always running out of money well before you run out of month. And so we were there on both counts, and things were not good. And, of course, within about 2.5-3 years, my dad saved up enough money to open up a tiny little, actually to buy a broken-down tailor shop from this guy who was losing his business. And my dad was a tailor. And anyway, quickly built himself a business over the next 3 to 5 years that ended up buying us a house. He ended up getting himself a rental property, et cetera. Unbeknownst to me, of course, my entire life, between the age of 6 and probably 15, I was getting this lesson on being an entrepreneur. Now, in that time when we came to America, you know, I went to 3 different elementary schools, 2 different junior high schools, and 2 different high schools, because we moved around so much, getting kicked out of apartments, my parents not being able to pay the rent, et cetera. And then, of course, so that gave me the ability to make friends quickly. We moved from city to city throughout Southern California, and I didn't know how many months or years I was going to be at that school, and so I had this ability to build rapport and friendship quickly, because, well, you need friends when you go to school. And so later on in life, of course, that translated into salesmanship, this ability to connect with people that I want to add value to their lives. So it's kind of like the Karate Kid story, you know, the kids standing down the fences and painting the fences and wondering, what does this have to do with karate? Little did he know that the motions that he's going through are the exact same motions that he'll be going through in a karate match. And so the rapport building ability skill set, you know, grew in me really quickly. Not only are we moving from city to city, but apartment from apartment to school, and so I'm making friends. And, of course, seeing my dad hustle, deliver value, unbeknownst to him, he had no idea that this tailor shop owner had created such a bad reputation for himself, that he owed money to people, that he was going bankrupt. And so, you know, he ran a gambling business in the back, and so it was really a lot of bad stuff out of that particular tailor shop. And so he not only took the business over and paid the guy $20,000 for it, but he had to turn the whole business around. And he did. Before you know it, celebrities were his customers, Macy's, JCPenney's, all these big department stores. And, you know, I all of a sudden get to see that, gosh, if you add value to people's lives, you know, you might want to hem their pants for free if they're a regular customer. Or maybe if they have a button that broke off their suit jacket, he just has them wait for 2 minutes while he sews that button back on and gives them the jacket. These people find a sense of reciprocity to not only come back again to him, but to tell others about him. And I don't know if my father, you know, did this instinctively or it was something that he had completely planned out. I imagine it was just he's a good person if he did it instinctively because he wanted to help people in general, and that was the best way to advertise for himself. And so, again, I learned that. And so when I moved into the fitness space, so I graduated high school, went to college. About a semester or two into college, I decided, you know, higher education is not for me. I love learning about exercise science, biomechanics, how the body works. I did not care one bit about, you know, English 101, mathematics 101, history 101, because I was forced to learn that stuff anyway and to learn it well because I had to assimilate and learn the language. Become a citizen, I had to know U.S. history and American history better than all of my peers in school who were just born as citizens. And so for me, it was just, you know, this is useless stuff. I'd rather use those higher grad credits for exercise science, nutrition, whatever. But, of course, you can. And so, you know, I had a nice long talk at the dean of the school and decided to drop out. And so as I dropped out, of course, by this point I was working out, knew that I wanted to get into the fitness field, started working as a personal trainer. And, you know, no one ever tells you that knowing all about the body and how your body processes nutrients and, you know, how it builds muscle and burns fat, none of that translates into getting more clients. And so I was that personal trainer who was a personal trainer and had a day job or a night job in some cases. So I was a bouncer at a nightclub. I was a fry cook at a restaurant. For a short period of time, I was a smog technician and a personal trainer. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, there is no doctor who's a doctor and a fry cook, a cop who's a cop and a bouncer, you know, but yet as a personal trainer, in my industry at least, it's always your personal trainer and something else. And so fortunately, one of my clients took mercy in me and after signing up on a personal training program, and he said, hey, you know what, I'm a mortgage broker, and you ought to listen to this audio tape. And the audio tape was of Tom Hopkins teaching salesmanship. And I said, well, why are you giving me this particular one? And they said, well, I just want you to know that you did not sell me any personal training. I bought personal training from you. You just took my order. You're an order taker. And I wonder how many people you let walk away who glad you could have changed if you only had some sales skills.
Yeah.
Gosh, you know, that was pretty harsh, but he speaks the truth. And so this particular client also taught me later on that there's three types of buyers. And so this is something very valuable to your listeners anyway. There's one-third of the people who will buy no matter what. And that's what he was. He was there to buy personal training, and I simply fulfilled an order. And then there's the other one-third of the people who are kind of undecided. And it's up to you to build rapport, establish value, obviously overcome any cost objections, and then sell them to whatever your product or service is. And then there's that final one-third of the group who is determined not to buy. And so if you have these amazing skills of building rapport, establishing value, you know, overcoming every objection that this person might have, even secondary objections that take place in their head, known as the secondary conversation that takes place in a consumer's head, and you can overcome that, you could even sell a few of the people who were committed to not buying. And so there's really the order taker, the closer, the salesperson, and then the heavy hitter, the way he described it. I had this aha moment and realized that, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm only closing one-third of these people coming to me. I'm taking orders. You know, I need to get to at least 65%, 75%, 85% close rate. And so the Tom Hopkins audio program led to Brian Tracy. Brian Tracy led to Jay Abraham. Jay Abraham led to Dan Kennedy. Dan Kennedy led to, you know, the information marketing space. And so in that time, I went from being a personal trainer, paying a modest rent to a small place to train clients, to owning multiple personal training centers throughout San Diego, and building those locations up to a near seven-figure business, and ultimately selling them, doing something that most small business owners only dream of doing, you know, when you're ready to leave an industry or to move on to a greater passion and calling or purpose, to not just close your business down, but to actually sell it for a massive profit. And so I was able to build legs in my business where I was then able to sell that off and move into the thing that I'm most passionate about right now, which is coaching and consulting small business owners, specifically personal trainers, those in the fitness industry, helping them achieve the freedom and the lifestyle that I did. So that's pretty much my story in a nutshell.
So, I mean, you covered an amazing amount of ground in terms of progress in a very short time. So, like, if you had to, I mean, there are plenty of people out there that didn't have to struggle through everything you did and still don't end up anywhere near where you are. What do you think is, like, the thing that's missing most out there in the service industry? It can be fitness or whatever you've encountered. What do you think all these people are missing that are struggling, if you had to pick one thing?
You know, I think that most people, the one thing they're missing is this never give up attitude. And I got to tell you, I read a lot of war history books, a lot of American history books. It's just I'm a history buff. And apparently I'm reading about the Navy SEALs at war. And I've read about Delta Force and how the Navy SEALs were born in the Vietnam era, et cetera. And I'm on my fourth or fifth book right now of Navy SEAL books. And the one common thread you hear amongst these Navy SEALs is it doesn't matter because, you know, they typically fight in small groups of 4, 5, 6, 10 versus 50, 100, 200 enemy combatants. And he says, you know, all these officers say the same thing. As a SEAL, whether it's 4-on-4 or 4-on-400, we go into that battle with a never-die, never-quit attitude. And we look at it as, I'm going to go, I'm going to conquer, and I'm going to come back and see my wife and kids and family. And that's this warrior's mentality and attitude that I believe is pretty prominent, maybe on World War II era and even in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And somehow people have become complacent. They'll give a little bit of effort, but not give that extra mile, right? And if you just have that never give up attitude, there's no way. It's hell or high water. I came here to get something, and I'm not leaving until I get it. And if I can find a coaching client that I can see that what I call the it factor in within them, I can take that person and put them on the right track. It's easier to take the person who's got the it factor, but not the right information.
Yeah.
Versus giving the right information to someone who just doesn't have this burning desire within them to hell or high water, I'm going to make it. That's really what's missing in the doers or the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, totally. And, I mean, at the end of the day, it really comes down to how that affects how we use our time. And I was on the phone not too long ago with Adam Blackwell, who I know you know. And I don't know if I'm going to get the terminology right, but I'd like you to talk about something that he mentioned he learned from you about using your time and about the whole 95-5 thing?
We've coined the term the Kulian method. And
Go ahead and tell us what that is.
So I realize, you know, we've all heard of the 80-20 rule, which is, you know, 20% of your efforts will give you 80% of your outcome. But what I really realized is in business, so you know, let's say salesmen. If you have 20 salesmen, you know, you're going to have probably 4 or 5 salesmen who are going to bring in 80% of the revenue in your business. And the other, whatever, 12 to 15 salesmen are just going to cover the rest of the 20%. Well, the same thing applies to entrepreneurs and their productivity and their time management and their self-management. And it's the 95-5 rule. And what that means is, as an entrepreneur, your job, Jason, my job, Adam Blackwell's job, or anybody listening to this who's the person who signs the front of the check, our job is usually to either sell or drive traffic or sell product or service to the traffic that's already come to us. And so there's usually about 5% of the things that you need to do on a daily basis to accomplish your big levers, what I call the big levers that move your business. You know, writing payroll checks isn't going to make your business move forward.
Yeah.
You know, going to Costco and buying toilet paper and cleaning supplies isn't going to do that. You know, figuring out how to put a website up isn't going to do that. Figuring out which hosting program is right for you isn't going to do that. Figuring out the signage isn't going to do that. What I figured out is there's about 5%. So if there's a list of 100 things that you do every day or every month to run your business that has to get done, you know, what I have all my coaching clients do is, all right, let's write down everything we need to do in a two-week period. Typically, you know, our lives are cyclical in a two-week period. In 2 weeks, everything you need to do to move your business. And it could be, you know, a spreadsheet of profit and loss statement that you have to do. Well, you can hire a bookkeeper for that instead of doing it yourself. If you're writing bills, you know, you can hire someone to write those bills. Have a $10 an hour assistant writing your bills instead of something that you should, you know, you could use that time for better things. And so you write down everything that you do in 2 weeks, and we put an X next to the things that are within your 5%, and they're usually involved with either improving business or making more money. And then we put an O next to the things that be outsourced. So the critical few are your 5%, and the trivial many are your 95%. And that 5% usually boils down to DMS, and that stands for Delegate, Motivate, and Sell. And that's what I teach all my coaching clients, and that's what I live by. I have 5 corporations, all doing 7 figures, and my job is to delegate to my staff as much as I can. I take anything I can and move it along to my staff. So that's the B part. M is the motivate. I motivate my staff to be on time, to do their work, and I motivate my business partners and affiliates. If I have more in my industry, I do have affiliates. So I motivate them to mail out for me because that has to do with making me money, right? And, of course, I do the sell part. So anything that has to do with writing new sales copy, writing email broadcasts, getting on the phone and talking to a vendor, that is obviously going to move their business to us. Anything that has to do with sales, writing, you know, a video sales letter, right? If I can't outsource it to you, then you and I, in fact, Jason, I've outsourced some of my, even my 5% over to you in the past because I've just been so busy that I'd rather outsource that to an expert like you than try and write mediocre, crappy copy. And so the more you can outsource the 95%, the better you become at the 5% that makes you money. Again, going back to the whole Navy SEALs, they are not jack of all trades. Each of those 4 or 5 guys in that tiny little platoon are good at one thing. One guy is really good at breaching the door. The other guy is really good at explosive. The other guy is just a master sniper, right? This other guy is the king of delivering the violence. And collectively, they work so well. But if they tried to be good at each individual task, they would never be a master at it. And so I like to master my 5%. I teach my coaching clients to master their 5%. And instead of spending 8, 10, 12 hours a day working on my entire business, I spend anywhere from 5 to maybe 6, 7 hours a day working on my 5% and just plow my business forward. And that's what really the whole Kulian method is all about.
So do you think that more people don't do that because, A, they don't know, B, they don't, for some reason, have the discipline to do their 5%? Or do you think there's another reason? I mean, why isn't this more common than it is as a way of operating?
Well, it's never been taught. You know, when I spoke 2 years ago at Yannick Silver's event, and you know Yannick Silver, he's a big internet marketer, has the online underground event. I spoke at Yannick Silver's event, Joe Polish's event, and when I teach this off the stage, everybody comes up to me afterwards and goes, oh, my God, you're so right. I can think of the 3, 5, 6 things that I should just be doing and outsource everything else. Like everyone listening to this call right now is going, yeah, I know exactly what my 5% is, and if I only focused on that, my business would plow ahead faster. No one's taught us this because I don't think any one of us probably sensed it but never really named it and figured it out and pinpointed it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we can spread the word on it. Great. Now, part of it is being disciplined because what ends up happening, and I'm guilty of this as well, is you go, you know what, I could do this faster than my assistant can, so I'll do this. I'll send out this broadcast instead of having him do it. You know what, I'll just find out which hosting platform to go with instead of delegating to my assistant. Before you know it, you take on 10%, 20%, 50%, and you're back to working really slow in your business. It's like moving through molasses instead of moving with speed. And so it's part discipline and part just not knowing.
Yeah, interesting. And I would imagine that 6 hours a day on your 5%, I mean, that's more than a lot of people do in a month. when you're operating the other way. That's an amazing amount of progress. Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit and talk about, if you're dealing with somebody that's like a consultant or like a professional that is concerned about how they attract clients. Now, oftentimes in business, when you think of successful people, you don't always get a picture of someone who's nice, who's accessible, and it's like they have to remind you all the time how good they are because it's part of their marketing shtick.
Right.
And you don't do that, and yet you perform at a very high level. So can you talk about, to all the people that are trying to figure out, how do I get clients without seeming like I need them? What's the right, positioning for me? Can you talk to all that?
I think what most people need to do is really become experts at the thing that they say they're an expert at. So, you know, rather than going into the physical therapy space and saying I can help physical therapists get clients, maybe if I were a good physical therapist and I built a physical therapy business and then I sold it for a massive profit, I can say I've been there and done that. That makes me an expert at it. Now, being an expert at something is great. Half the people listening to this are going, okay, got that one covered, check. And the other thing is dramatic demonstration of proof. And I make sure, while I don't go out there beating my chest and saying I'm the best, you know, fitness marketing guru or coach out there and that I've helped 6 personal trainers make 7 figures in the industry and thousands get to multiple 6 figures, which I have. Instead, my coaching clients go out there and do that for me. If you look at my Facebook wall, you know, it's always, hey, I finally broke 6 figures. Thank you, Vedras Tulian, for letting me be in your 7-figure formula mastermind group. The mastermind that you came out to, Jason, that Craig and I run, you know, we're constantly creating 6- and 7-figure earners, and they're writing blog posts for us. And so we're constantly taking the coaching clients that we've transformed their lives and businesses, and we're putting them in front of our audience and saying, look at what this guy did, and using them as case studies. And I think not enough entrepreneurs, consultants, coaches are using case studies. Instead, they go out there and say, here's what I specialize in, and here's why you should work with me. So I could say that I could build the best rocket ship to take you to the moon. Now, if I can put 10 people in front of you that say Vedras actually builds the best rocket ship, and I've gone to the moon in that rocket ship, and look at me, I'm back now, and it was a great experience, that holds a lot more value to the prospect than me saying how awesome I am, how badass I am, and what a great rocket ship I can build. And so dramatic demonstration of proof, being an expert at what you're good at, and so, of course, having a great story, my story, I'm fortunate enough, or very unfortunate enough, I've gone through a lot of challenges in my life, but I look at it as a fortune that's my story. I went into the personal training niche. I was horrible at it because of the lack of business skills. I gained those business skills because I worked really hard at them, and I proved that I'm an expert at that business because then I was able to sell off my locations for a massive profit. And not only is that my part of my story, but then I go, I've done it for others, and here they are. And they'll write blog posts for me. I'll use them in the case study and email broadcast. When I have my fitness business summit, my live event, which every person listening to this should have some kind of a live event. It doesn't have to be 500 person big. It could be 10 or 15 potential prospects that you're trying to court. Get them, bring them to your office or get them into a hotel conference room for a weekend and put 3 or 4 of your best clients in front of them to teach and to demonstrate proof. And I promise you at the end of that weekend, the people in the audience are going to go, how much do I have to pay to work with you? And I'd rather be on that side of the table, someone asking me what's the cost, rather than me saying, hey, look, you know, if you work with me, I can make you a lot of money. Because in their head, and this is that secondary conversation I talked about earlier, what most green entrepreneurs don't realize is there's always a secondary conversation happening. So as I'm telling you, Jason, I'm the best business consultant on the planet. I can help you take your business to multiple 6 figures, help automate your business, and help you streamline your finances, and oh, by the way, win your freedom. In your head, now you could be saying, uh-huh, great, that sounds exciting and fantastic, Vedras, but in your head, the secondary conversation could very well be, I don't think so, I don't believe you, how do I know? Proof,
right?
How do I know you've done it? What do I know about you? But if I could demonstrate proof through others, that eliminates all secondary conversation, eliminates all potential objections, and invites you to ask me, Vedras, what does it take to work with you? And that's what I really specialize in.
Yeah. And at the same time, you're adding value to all those people's lives that are your success stories that you're putting up in front of huge numbers of people.
Absolutely. And if you know, I think it was Evan Pagan said, you know, take the best part of one of your products, the best thing, and give it away for free. And he called, you know, pushing the free line. And
right.
give that best thing away for free. Because when you give your best information away for free, which, you, again, demonstration of proof, that you are the man and or woman and good at what you do, then they're only going to go, gosh, if this free information is this valuable, gosh, I imagine what it would be like working with him or her. And so we sometimes also get a little scarcity-minded and think that, you know, I need to guard my information. Listen, the information's out there. I can go on YouTube and learn how to do anything, how to market a personal training business, how to get clients, how to write great copy. It's out there for free. We want to pay for it because it comes to us, you know, in a systematic order and from an expert. However, give me a reason to pay for it. And so if we can demonstrate proof by putting our coaching clients or other people that we've helped and coached and mentored out there to tell our story, and then by us constantly demonstrating that and adding value to the industry, you know, I read a book recently called Turning Pro. I sent out an email to my email list and said, hey, guys, you know, this is not an affiliate link. I just read this book. It's an awesome book called Turning Pro. And I think you guys should all read it. And here's the Amazon link to it. And, oh, by the way, this is not an affiliate link. I don't make a penny from it. I don't know the author. And, you know, a couple dozen people over the last 2 weeks have emailed me and said, oh, my gosh, what a great book, what a great read. I realized I was operating as an amateur, and now I'm turning pro. And so that one piece of value I injected into their life absolutely free, which wasn't even my content, it was someone else's, helped position me as an expert, and now they turn to me and say, well, what else can I do?
Yeah, excellent. Okay, so let's now focus on something that becomes an issue when you do start getting successful as a service provider and you realize, oh my goodness, there are only so many hours in the day. I can't, if you have a family, like I have other commitments in my life, I have to build leverage into my business. Can you talk about how, I'm sure that conversation happened in your head over the years. What is a service provider supposed to do to grow in terms of profitability over time without killing themselves?
Yeah, that's a really good question because that becomes this other challenge that business owners have. The first challenge is, oh, my gosh, I need clients and I need to know how to market. And as soon as you solve that problem for them and they get clients and they know how to market, typically problem number two is, hey, I need staff. And if they can overcome the staff issue, then it's, oh, my gosh, I still have too many clients. What do I do to leverage? And in this case, it's about scalability. And I'll use personal training as an example. Because not only am I near and dear to that, but I think the word picture I draw here will make complete sense. If you imagine most personal trainers, especially at least a decade ago, personal training was just done one trainer, one client. You know, we either show up to your house with some exercise bands and balls and dumbbells, or you meet your trainer in the gym, and it's one trainer for 60 minutes, and then that trainer goes on and trains somebody, you know, another client for 60 minutes, and another client, and hopefully you don't have any gaps in your schedule, so that you can actually have a 4, 5, 6, 8-hour day. That's fantastic. But at some point, you know, you're probably going to want to get married. You want to get a family and a life. You want to go on vacation. You probably want to have some time to get sick. And in our industry as a trainer, and probably most industries where you're kind of tied into delivering the service, you don't have time for any of that, man. And so where our industry is evolving to now, because personal training is a relatively new niche, new industry, it's, you know, under 20 years old, kind of like the internet. And so where it's gone now is to small group personal training. So now we've gone to scalability. So instead of saying, all right, well, let's get a lot of staff, because then, like Robert Allen says, employees are like ticking time bombs. You never know when one of them is going to explode in your face. You know, if I have 100 clients, I could either have 10 to 12 trainers training one-on-one, which means my payroll is always chasing my revenue, and I have all the staff to manage, which, again, becomes that too many clients, too much, too many things to manage. Or I can start training in boot camps and in small groups where those 100 clients can get serviced by 2, maybe 3 trainers total, and training clients in groups of anywhere from 8, 10, 20, 30 people at a time. And so in every business, now let's go back to my business. Let's talk about scalability there. As a personal trainer who then turned into coaching and consulting trainers, I've got information products and the job of those information products are to give trainers enough information to grow their business so that hopefully they can afford my coaching and consulting services. You know, that's the, to me, they're a lead magnet to the next product or service that I have. And by golly, it worked. I had 10, 15, and then 20, and then 25 coaching clients. But before I knew it, I was on the phone all the time with these coaching clients, on the emails, and realizing, oh, my gosh, all of my entire days are spent coaching and consulting over the phone, and I'm not broadcasting anymore, sending out info products. I'm not doing live events anymore. I'm not doing interviews like this. And it became really cumbersome. I couldn't go on vacations and breaks or whatever because my coaching clients needed me. They paid me a handsome fee. So what I did about 4 years ago now is I said, hey, guys, guess what? We're starting something called the Mastermind. And this Mastermind, which is nothing new, is a group of people in a room where I facilitate the meetings. And so, you know, went from that one-on-one model to the group model. So we meet 3 to 4 times a year now for a long, you know, 2 or 3 day weekend, and the whole group is there. I spend that entire concentrated time working on each of their problems. And lo and behold, because of the value of the group, each individual gets greater value than they did than with just working with me. Because, you know, I mean, I might not know if this particular marketing piece is going to work for you or not, but the guy across from you down that in that table may have tried that piece and will tell you, you know what, it won't work, but if you tweak it this way, it will, because I've done that. And so, you know, it's about scaling your business and then knowing when to hire staff to outsource to. And so those are the two big things. Again, you know, when it comes to your 5%, definitely within my 5% to talk and communicate and mentor and consult my coaching clients. It is definitely not in my 5% to find out if their payments went through this month. If we sent them the monthly gift that we send our coaching clients, my staff handles that. You know, if their payment didn't go through, then my staff will tell me, hey, we've got a problem with this coaching client, so when you talk to them next, can you let them know that they need to call, you know, hand the phone over to me afterwards so they can square up on their payment. And so again, I focus on my 5%, and that's going back to that. Focus on the critical few and not the trivial many, and then, of course, scale your business by grouping like items or businesses or services together.
Awesome. Cool. I have one more question for you. If you had to say one thing that, had you known this back when you got started, it would have made your journey a whole lot easier, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, for me, and I imagine for a lot of entrepreneurs, it was the same way, we are perfectionists to a fault. And in fact, Craig Ballantyne says it best. He says, look, you know, for every day that you delay putting out your product, your service, your knowledge, your content, because you're attempting to perfect it, there's someone out there crying themselves to sleep because their business is failing, their marriage is failing. If you have a, you know, marital product, their fitness and fat, they're getting fatter and they're losing their fitness if you're not putting your fitness product out there. And so the one thing I can tell you is take imperfect action. You know, not only be a person of action, but don't be a perfectionist. Perfect doesn't exist. And so if we take imperfect action, get our product out there, just good enough is good enough, we will fix it, and we will get great feedback from the people using it, and they'll tell us exactly how we should perfect it further, rather than guessing and always keeping it on the drawing board and never putting it out there. And so I truly believe that the person who does not take imperfect action is the person who is selfish. And they're selfish because they're more concerned about their own feelings and how they feel about their product or service than adding value and servicing the people that they've committed to helping. So taking perfect action is my answer.
And that's a pretty motivating way to think about it, indeed. Well, cool. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Where can people go to find out more about who you are, what you do, who you help, and what your 5% is?
The best place to go is probably to my blog, and the blog is ptpower.com, my personal trainer, ptpower.com, and you know, they could reach out to me there, or you know, since I'm the only guy named Bedros that I know, you can just Google Bedros, and my blog will come up.
Awesome. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. We'll be right back.